Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Marcy Yoncancio, filling in today for Roger McDonough. Coming up on the program, an Instagram account sharing anonymous stories renews conversation about BYU's honor code. John Huntsman Jr. explores a return to Utah politics, and state sex ed standards get an update, but keep the focus on abstinence. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner, who's with us by phone from Provo. Hi, Courtney. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Government and politics editor Dan Harry. Morning, Dan.
Good morning.
And news columnist Robert Gerke.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome, Robert.
Yeah, thank you.
We invite you to join us for the conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can tweet us at KCPW or post your questions at sltrib.com. So, kicking off with our first story, Courtney, we are going to start with you. The BYU Honor Code is back in the news after this anonymous Instagram account was flooded with stories about the Honor Code office, which is that office that enforces the student code of conduct at the university. What do we know about this account and where it came from?
Sure. So this account actually started in January. It just kind of got some renewed interest this month. So a former student created the account because she was frustrated with how her case was handled by the Honor Code office. And so she posted her story, and then she encouraged other students and alumnus to post theirs as well.
Great. And so what are some of the stories? What is the student's name, and what is her story that kind of kicked this whole thing off?
Sure. So this student is Sydney Drawn, and she actually had two interactions with the Honor Code office. So the first one, she went into the Honor Code office, and they had printed out a tweet that she had liked when she was in high school a couple years earlier, and then a photo that she had taken with some friends a year earlier that they had decided was immodest. And so she was kind of surprised to see these on the table, and she got suspended for that. And then the second case, a former boyfriend of hers went into the Honor Code office, said that they had broken the school's rules for sexual touching before marriage, and she got suspended for that as well.
So she was sort of turned into the office then. Is that a common story?
That's right. And it is pretty common. Just looking at these stories that have been posted on Instagram, a lot of them start with, you know, my roommate turned me in, or this classmate turned me in. And a lot of the students we've talked to said that there is, you know, this expectation that you turn each other in, that there's encouragement from church leaders and school leaders to kind of rat out, you know, your classmates, essentially.
Well, and this is, I mean, so much has been said about the Honor Code, you know, recently. But I think that it's probably important to say that the Honor Code isn't just about inappropriate sexual touch, but there's a wide variety of other things that people sign when they agree to this. So what's in the Honor Code, and what's punishable or considered a violation of that?
You're right. So kind of the biggest things that get touched on are, you know, that it prohibits premarital sex and kind of touching that goes a little too far, according to their standards, but it also sets rules for, you know, when and how dating should occur. It contains a dress code for people to be modest, and it prohibits the consumption of alcohol, drugs, coffee, and tea. So students sign this when they go into the university and agree to uphold the standards.
So, and right now, that Instagram account has really gone viral since its launch, but mostly over the last couple of weeks. Right now, it looks like there's almost 36,000 followers, and really just a matter of days, 175 or so posts. And your story, you report that there's actually that Drawn, apologies if I'm saying her name incorrectly there, but your story says that she's got several hundred more stories from students about this Honor Code. What has been the reaction to this, this viral account?
Yeah, so she, when we talked to her last week, she had posted 110 stories, so it's gone up since then. She said, you know, my inbox has 400 more. So there's been a lot of interest in people sharing their stories. This account is anonymous, but a lot of people have posted them on their own account saying, you know, this was my experience with the Honor Code office, and I want to tell you about it, and I want to be open and transparent, and let's talk about this process, and let's get things fixed. And I will point out, too, that most of these students, you know, they don't disagree with BYU, they don't disagree with the church, and they don't even disagree with the honor code itself. They're just frustrated with how it's enforced, with how students are disciplined.
Yeah, so talk about that a little bit more, because I spent some time going through a good portion of these posts over the last couple of days, and one thing that you see coming up over and over and over again is that students like the honor code. That's part of the appeal of going to BYU or to a BYU school, is that they are there for part of the values and the religious code that comes with being a student at BYU. So what is the conflict here between the punishments or the violations and how they're doled out by the Honor Code office and what the Honor Code actually says and what the students want from it?
Sure, yeah, and you're exactly right. I mean, a lot of these students say, you know, we went to BYU because we liked that there was an Honor Code, because we liked that the other students had the same values that we did. Their objections focus on how the school handles allegations of misconduct and how it imposes punishment. And so a lot of them, you know, some of the bigger problems are that they want to do away with anonymous reporting. So BYU Provo says that it doesn't really allow anonymous reporting unless it's like an extreme case, but, you know, their different campuses vary. So Idaho allows anonymous reporting. And then they also want students to be able to bring in, you know, some support in, throughout this disciplinary process, someone who can back them up and talk about their case and give them support. And then a lot of them also want the honor code to just realize, you know, that students are going to make mistakes and to be a little bit more lenient instead of going straight from you made this mistake to now you're going to be expelled from the school.
Well, and I want to read one of the recent posts. This was posted a day ago to the Honor Code Stories account on Instagram. And it says, quote, "I withdrew from the school not too long ago. I wasn't in trouble or anything, but one experience with the Honor Code office made me extremely paranoid with everywhere I went and everything I did. I was called in, but due to their lack of evidence, I walked out unpunished." One of the themes that's coming up in a lot of these posts as well is that students are worried that their peers are reporting them. And on the other side, peers say that they feel pressured to report violations from leaders in the church. How is that playing out in all of this?
Yeah, I definitely think that there's a sense of kind of paranoia, you know, that students are kind of watching each other and being encouraged to turn each other in. BYU put out a Q&A with its honor code director this week, and they said, you know, you won't be punished if you don't turn someone in, right, if you don't report misconduct. But a lot of the students we talked to said, you know, my bishop encouraged me to turn people in, and before I went to the school, I was kind of coached on how to do that and why I should do that and if it was wrong if I didn't do that.
Interesting. Well, I want to throw in a quick reminder to our listeners to join this conversation. If you have any thoughts about this or you have any experiences with the Honor Code that you'd like to share with us, that would be great. You can call in at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. So, Courtney, you are joining us by phone from Provo today. What is going on down there?
That's right. So BYU is going to have a sit-in from some of these students who have called out this honor code office. And so we'll kind of see how that goes. It's a pretty rare occurrence for there to be any kind of protest or rally on this campus.
And so one of the planners of this protest is an 18-year-old student, Grant Frazier, and he describes himself as a good student who loves the church and being a BYU student. But as an 18-year-old and kind of newbie at the school, he believes that the honor code goes against the values of the faith, as you wrote in your story. What is his involvement in this? Why did he plan it? What's he saying now?
Yeah, he has this kind of interesting quote in the story where he says, "I'm a freshman, I have my whole life ahead of me. Why don't I be the one to fight this?" And so I think he's kind of taken this on as a way to help other students who may be afraid to talk and afraid to share their stories. And he's kind of taking that on and opening up conversation.
And so you talked a little bit about some of those changes that they want to see. What are the specific changes that they're hoping might come from this sit-in today?
Yeah, so I think the biggest one is that they just want some more understanding in this disciplinary process.
Okay. And has the school been responsive to this? Have they engaged with students at all? I think you mentioned a tweet. in your story?
Yeah, so administrators have said that they have been in contact with these students, and the students have also reported that they've talked to school officials. So there's been some conversation on the Provo campus, and I'd like to point out that my colleague Jessica Miller went up to Idaho, the BYU-Idaho campus this week, where they had a similar protest. But the school officials there basically declined to talk to students, wouldn't interact with them at all. So there's a little bit of a difference between the campuses.
Okay. And so up at BYU-Idaho, this was a couple of days ago, there was a protest of about how many students were engaged in that? Do you know?
Nearly 200.
Okay. So that's a pretty big group of people. And that protest went to a couple of the offices at BYU-Idaho, but we're told by officials in those offices that they didn't have time to talk to the students. They tried two different offices, was my read from Jessica's story.
Yeah, they kind of turned them away, I guess.
So are the students who are planning the sit-in today expecting more engagement from school officials down in Provo?
It's unclear. I mean, Provo has definitely been a little bit more receptive so far. I don't know how much they'll interact today with the sit-in. They have given approval for the sit-in to take place. And the organizers themselves say, you know, this is peaceful. This is just a demonstration. We want to have talks. We want this to be constructive.
Good. And so one more thing I want to talk about is I do want to go back to cases of sexual assault where victims of sexual assault have reported that and then have been turned into the Honor Code office and have had repercussions, including being put on probation from school, having to delay their degree. What are they saying about this being a form of re-victimization? That's a thread that you're seeing in some of these stories.
I think that's definitely a part of this, is that, you know, going through the Honor Code office and telling your story or having someone else turn you in for a story that involves abuse is kind of like having to relive that. BYU did grant amnesty to Honor Code violations with students reporting sexual abuse in 2016. So they're trying to address that, essentially, but I don't know that it's all the way fixed yet.
And do we know if there's been a decrease in that since 2016? A lot of these stories are coming out now, but do we know if that actually has become less of a punishment since that came about a couple of years ago?
I think that will still remain to be seen. And a lot of these stories on the Instagram account kind of vary based on like when they happen. So some of those, you know, happened before this amnesty was granted. So it's kind of unclear how it's helped so far.
Okay, great. So Robert Gerke, columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune, want to turn to you on this. BYU has been in the news quite a bit for issues related to the Honor Code, not just this week, but really for the last couple of years.
Yeah, if you go back, if you mentioned the instances of rape and sexual assault that were mishandled, I guess, by the university in going back several years. They were actually, the Honor Code office was one of the offices on campus that was receiving police documents that were supposedly confidential, investigative documents, and then using those to punish the victims of these crimes. And so, you know, that was seen as, I think, to the school's credit, they tried to rectify that and say they weren't going to do that anymore. You recently had, I believe it was 2 months ago, had a group of athletes, starting with Derek Stevenson, who was a linebacker at BYU, come out and say that, you know, the Honor Code office needs to change. Athletes felt like they were being singled out, I guess. And Stevenson in particular was talking about how he had all these injuries from playing football and got hooked on pain pills so he could kind of function. But he had to keep that addiction hidden because that would have been an Honor Code violation. And so there were other athletes that then kind of jumped on that train and said that the Honor Code office definitely needed to be reformed. And now we see this this latest example. And this latest example, I think, is really getting a lot of attention. It's very social media driven, as Courtney mentioned. If you mentioned you read the Instagram account. You go in the Instagram account, and a lot of these are anonymous in the sense that they don't identify who they are, But you do start to see trends in all of these stories. And then if you go to Twitter or you go to other social media pages, you see names put to a lot of them. And it's interesting. As Courtney mentioned, one of the common themes is these students who are feel like they were turned in by either a fellow boyfriend or girlfriend or else a roommate, or, you know, and things that they had done in the past had repented for, that, you know, in the church's eyes, then become an issue for them right as they're about to graduate or as they're further on. There was one instance, one that I read on the Instagram account, and again, since these are anonymous, verification is a problem, but it was a sibling who said that her brother had been turned in by, or reported to the honor code office by a former girlfriend, and right before he was about to graduate, they kicked him out of school, and this young man killed himself. So, you know, you start seeing that there are consequences here. I mean, in my column over the week, in response to this, I said, you know, look, these are teenagers at the end of the day, and they're going to make mistakes. The Honor Code Office, is it focused on retribution or repentance and reform? And if it's the latter, you know, if the goal is to you know, keep these children on the straight and narrow path, as the church puts it, then there's room for forgiveness there. And so, you know, I think it's a valuable discussion that it sparked, and hopefully that this, you know, with this protest today, that there, it won't be the end of it.
Yeah, and it's really bringing out the wide variety of kind of violations in the Honor Code too. It's interesting to see all of these stories where that span from people not coming out because they're worried about coming out as gay or bisexual to wearing running shorts in their apartment and a roommate reporting them for that, and really everything in between, cheating, drinking.
It impacts every aspect, I think, of a BYU student's life in one way or another. I mean, because you are with these roommates who, if you get a zealous roommate, there's, you know, stories about being reported to the Honor Code Office for watching a PG-13 movie, or having, you know, they have strict curfews and, you know, strict rules on having members of the opposite sex in the dorm rooms. And so there's, you know, it turns into this sort of almost like a Spanish Inquisition type, you know, dynamic where you're being ordered to tattle or directed to tattle on other people. And, you know, for violations sometimes serious and sometimes petty, and the consequences don't seem to vary all that much.
Right, and it really just seems like students want some consistency. Yeah. Collectively, they're saying, we want this honor code, but we want it to be consistent.
Yeah, and I haven't heard anybody say that BYU should get rid of the honor code, or you know, I think there's a universal recognition that this is a church-run school, and that there will be church values expected to be abided to and adhered to by students. And so I haven't heard anybody say that they need to get rid of the honor code. I think it's just the mechanism that's used to implement it.
Right. Good. And it sounds like students want this honor code too.
Yeah.
So it's time for our first break. Thank you for the conversation on that. Coming up, one of the state's largest police departments is considering getting rid of officer body cameras. And there's concerns on this on both sides. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Marcy Young-Cancio, in for Roger McDonough. And I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner, who's with us by phone from Provo, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and news columnist Robert Gerke. We'd love for you to join us in the conversation with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255, or you can post them to the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com or tweet us at KCPW. So we're moving on to law enforcement, Courtney. The Unified Police Department, one of the largest forces in the state, is looking at getting rid of its body cameras. And some people, especially families of people shot by officers, aren't happy about this. Why is UPD considering this move?
The biggest thing that they're citing is just the cost. So it costs quite a bit for any police force in the state to just kind of retain the video storage from these body cameras. So they're kind of wondering, as they prepare their budget this year, if they should cut cameras entirely.
And so you reported in your story earlier this week that the UPD has already funded $146,000 toward the costs and then has had to pay an additional $348,000 just for the camera and that storage. So you're talking about $500,000.
That's right. So a grant has covered the $146,000, but yeah, Unified Police Department has essentially paid $300,000 since it started this program in mid-2017. So about a year and a half worth of having these cameras has paid about $300,000 for them.
And it sounds like people both in law enforcement and on the board want to keep the cameras, but that financial piece of it is just such a big decision and is such a big piece of that decision. But families who have been shot by the police aren't happy about this possibility that they could go away. And they showed up at a UPD board meeting Wednesday night to make that known. What did that protest look like outside beforehand?
Sure. So there was a group of about 40 people that kind of showed up outside of the Unified Police Department's offices just to protest this, essentially. A lot of those included, you know, family members of people who had been shot by police in Utah. That includes the brother of Cody Bellegarde, who was shot recently in November, as well as the aunt of Dylan Taylor. And so these folks just kind of stood outside and said, you know, we want these body cameras, and they protect both of us. They protect just regular residents, you know, because they think that police who wear them will act, you know, more kindly and watch their behavior because they know it's being filmed, but it will also protect police officers against false allegations.
Right. And so it goes for both sides as a protection for both police officers to kind of vindicate a possible shooting and to show what the interaction was between officers and the person shot. So when they moved, this group then moved inside for the board meeting, and you reported that there was a line of 20 people who had comments about the idea of the cameras going away. What did they say, and what were their arguments?
Sure. A lot of the folks, you know, talked about how people of color, particularly, their communities are statistically the most likely to be affected by police brutality, and that was kind of a big part of the conversation. But a lot of the people also talked about, you know, these cameras create a sense of public trust. This shouldn't be about cost. This should be about, you know, making sure that you have good relationships with the residents that you're trying to protect.
And so since the UPD started using these cameras, you reported that there's been more than 1,600 cases of use of force, and 23 of those have resulted in complaints, with 7 involving body camera footage. How did the body camera footage play into decisions that were made there?
With the prosecution on those, all of those officers were actually cleared in those cases, those 7 cases.
So there's a clear benefit to law enforcement in this, too. And even though there's this big budget concern, you have people from all sides, the sheriff's office, the board, the Utah Senate. Dan McKay even wrote in saying that the cameras should stay. What did Dan McKay say about that, and what was he willing to kind of bring to the table from a legislative side?
Yeah, so Senator McKay has sponsored legislation in the past on this issue. He's looked at requiring police forces to keep this footage, but he said, you know, I've always stopped short of that, and now he's kind of rethinking that, and he's wondering if he should draft new legislation next year that might help, you know, pay these bills for these departments to essentially help them keep funding these body cameras.
Good. So, Dan Harry, I want to bring you in here. How responsive has the Utah legislature been to budget requests for police body cameras over the years and more recently?
I don't know that I can answer that.
So maybe that's
This past session, the Department of Public Safety came in looking for some funding because they've deployed body cameras over the years. They were pretty smart about the way they did it. I think they have 425 troopers now who have body cameras, but they kind of phased it in. So they ramped it up. They had their, you know, the people on the front lines first, and then kind of scaled it in. But they did need more money because keeping this, I think it was, they have this vast amount of video that they're collecting as well. And there are rules about how long you keep it because under, you know, state records laws, this is a record, this body camera footage, and particularly when you have complaints or you have or you have a use of force, you know, it becomes something that you need to retain. And so it's not cheap, it's not easy, but I think, you know, when I talk to law enforcement people, I talk to the head of the Department of Public Safety, he said, you know, it's something that they think is important and worth doing. They got the money from the legislature. At the state level, now that doesn't filter down to, again, unified or other counties or cities. Chief Brown from Salt Lake Police Department said that he, you know, his officers think it's one of the most valuable tools that they've got, and they wouldn't go out on the street, you know, go work their beat without the body cameras anymore. There was some resistance to them at first, but they've been embraced, partly because, as Courtney said, they're just as often beneficial to the officers as they are to the citizens. You know, they're just as often exculpatory as they are, you know, an indictment of their officers' conduct. And there's actually have been studies out of the Las Vegas Police Department that said that they save money, because if you don't have this footage available, you get a complaint, you have to do this lengthy investigation where you bring everybody in and interview them, and you know, and there have been both decreases in the number of complaints against officers that have body cameras, decreases in the use of force incidents of officers that have body cameras, and savings on the investigative end of these complaints and use of force incidents. So all of these kind of contribute to this, I think, almost universal consensus that the body cameras should stay. And then the question becomes, well, who's going to pay for it?
Right.
Well, I notice on the UPD that part of that is through a grant. I think it's a federal grant. And mm-hmm. So, you know, that grant money is running out, and that's one of the issues there. You know, this is an important thing, and I think police agencies recognize that. On the other hand, like many other things, they're competing with other critical needs. You know, you saw recently in Salt Lake City where police officers were attending the city council meeting saying, you've got to increase our pay. You know, we haven't had a significant pay increase in years, and I can't, you know, bring up a family on this. I'm going out there risking my life every day. If you can't pay us more, we're going to have to try to go somewhere else, to one of the newer cities maybe who are paying more. So it is one of those issues, you know, you can't look at this in isolation. There are a lot of other needs out there too.
Because if you don't have police officers, then you can't really put body cameras
That's right.
All right. I want to remind listeners to join this conversation by calling in at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or tweet us at KCPW with your questions and comments. So I want to move on to some other news. Dan Harry, Tribune Government and Politics Editor, let's start with you on this one. John Huntsman Jr., former Utah governor and current ambassador to Russia, may be considering a return to Utah for another bid at the top seat in the state. What has been the reaction to this?
Well, a lot of people reacting to it are saying, what the? you know, it would be in a very unusual event that somebody with Huntsman's stature, who has done this before, twice or one and a half times, would come back and do it again. It's just not something that happens very often. And so there's been a lot of surprise that this is a real possibility. I think many people are still skeptical that it will happen. But if it did happen, a lot of people concede, you know, he probably would be an immediate front runner in this race.
Well, and it's probably a good time to note that Ambassador John Huntsman is the brother of Tribune owner and publisher John Huntsman, before we jump into more conversation about this.
Yeah, we're going to have fun. If he comes back and runs, how are we going to cover that? That's going to be, because even...
So many editor's notes and disclosures.
And even if we did it, you know, to the best of our ability, completely objectively, people are going to think we're in the bag. But we're kind of a little paralyzed, I think, with the whole prospect that he might come back and run. But... You know, we'll see how it goes. I mean, the from what we were hearing, it sounds like there'll be a decision before the end of the year, possibly as early as this summer. And you know, he has written to friends and supporters here in Utah and said that he's considering his life after his ambassadorship, after his time in Russia is up, and it's unlikely that he would run for the Senate, but. You know, he's leaving open the option of possibly running for governor, and so yeah, it was sort of a seismic event, I think, in that field, because right now it's been shaping up to be Spencer Cox, Greg Hughes, sort of the two front runners, and possibly Jason Chaffetz, and then the rest, sort of like a Gilligan's Island reference, I guess. but you throw Huntsman into the mix, I think what you would probably see is Hughes would not run. Cox probably would, and the rest of the field would have to kind of weigh their options accordingly. But, you know, when you have somebody with name recognition, he has his approval rating when he left was in the mid-80s, you know. Another thing that he previously would have been a problem for him, frankly, is getting through the convention system. Yeah. The diehard Republican conservatives were not necessarily fans of his because they didn't see him as a true Republican conservative. He was too liberal for them. But now we have this signature gathering path. You know, he could skate through pretty easily there, and punch his ticket to the general election. And you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised if he did get to a general election that more Democrats would vote for him than for the Democratic candidate.
Right, if there's a Democratic candidate, right?
Yeah, no, we're not sure who it's going to be yet. Are you interested? No, I'm kidding.
So Huntsman himself hasn't publicly commented on this, though, right? This is coming through these letters and conversations.
His public comment was something like, "I'm focused on the job I'm involved in now," or something like that. So.
Okay, so you mentioned a bunch of these names, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, former House Speaker Greg Hughes, former U.S. Representative Jason Chaffetz. They're all names that are being swung around as potential candidates. None of them have committed to that. But there's a whole bunch, all of those, the rest, as you say, are also all Republicans. Yeah. So is this surprising for a state that had glimmers of purple during the midterms?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the last several Democratic candidates, they get somewhere right around 30% of the vote, and that's sort of the ceiling, I think, for them. The reason there were glimmers of purple was because there was another conservative in the field at the presidential level, but you saw all the way down I was talking 2016 and 2018. It's still a very Republican state, and at the state level, I don't see anybody who could actually put a dent in that.
You also see a lot of the reaction to Huntsman if he got in. Democrats loved John Huntsman as governor. You've had several of them say, you know, we hope that he runs because they feel that he is more moderate than other Republican candidates in the field.
And they know that there's almost no chance that we're going to elect a Democrat as governor, so he's sort of the next best thing.
Right. And you've heard, I mean, even when he had his short-lived bid for president, you heard Democrats saying, you know, I would vote for a John Huntsman. There's been that kind of middle ground with him for a long time. So what are some of those other candidates or those names saying about this news that Huntsman may be coming back to Utah and eyeing the governor's seat? What's Cox saying? What's Chaffetz saying?
You know, I think they're trying to kind of keep their powder dry right now. They're all they're praising Ambassador Huntsman's commitment to service and family, and we would welcome him back to the state. I think they're kind of hedging their bets. I think Hughes would not run. I think Cox probably would. Chaffetz hasn't decided whether he's going to run or not. He said he's a definite maybe still on this.
Cox had an interesting comment. He kind of gave a backhanded compliment and said, gee, if Ambassador Huntsman hadn't resigned as governor when he did, I wouldn't be here as lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
So he was kind of pointing out that he didn't finish the term last time. So.
Right. Yeah. And that quote, I have this in front of me, that quote from Spencer Cox was, I quote, I personally owe him a debt of gratitude. If he didn't resign early, it's very unlikely I would later get the chance to serve as lieutenant governor with Governor Herbert.
Yeah, so, you know, some definite sarcasm in that comment, you can see.
Right, and if you know anything about Spencer Cox's, at least Twitter presence, he definitely has a little bit of a bite there when it comes to his approach. So one last thing on this before we move on to our next story. Robert Gerke, we'll end with you. In July, you penned a column imploring Huntsman to return home after President Trump's, quote, disgraceful press conference with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Zelensky. Given everything that's happened since then, do you think that would have an impact or an effect on how Utahns would view Huntsman? Should he come back home?
No, I think he's still popular in the state. I think he's obviously got the money to run a strong race. And if he comes back and wants to run for governor, I think he would be the favorite regardless of any of the ties to Russia. I mean, I think there's a perception that, you know, maybe some disappointment was expressed by Utahns when he accepted the job as ambassador to Russia. And but I think they take him at his word when he responded to my column, for example, when he says it's out of a sense of duty to country. I think that's how they perceive this. I think there's probably more of a liability, frankly, that he took the job as ambassador to China for Barack Obama before he ran for president. I think that would probably cause more concern among the Republican electorate than this Russian stint.
Okay, interesting. All right, it's now time for another break in the show. Still to come, updates to the sex ed standards for the first time in 2 decades, including what's not changing. This is Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Marcy Young-Cancio, filling in for Roger McDonough. And I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Courtney Tanner, Dan Harry, and Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting us at KCPW. So, Courtney, we're back to you with this next story, sex education standards in Utah schools. They've gotten an update after 2 decades. What's new here?
Sure. So the board has been looking at these sex ed standards for 2 years, and you're right, it's been 20 years since they've updated them. They gave final approval to these new set of guidelines. To most people, they'll look pretty much the same. They're kind of continuing with this stress on abstinence. But there are some new additions as well. I mean, teachers are now kind of allowed to talk a little bit more about the different methods of contraception. Again, not a lot more. You still can't, like, encourage basically premarital or extramarital sexual activity, but they can kind of evaluate these different methods like condoms and birth control. And overall, the standards will also apply to kindergarten and second grade for the first time.
So talk about that a little bit. Kindergarten and second grade, what are the standards applying to those grade levels?
Sure. And I should mention it's health standards overall. So sex education is a part of this. It's generally the most controversial part because Utah is a pretty conservative state and a lot of the board members want to stress family values. So health standards overall, K through second grade, will mostly focus on, you know, healthy eating, that kind of basic introduction to health things, exercising, that kind of thing.
All right. So there's no condom and birth control talk for the 5 years.
Nothing that early.
Okay. So what is the language that's changing around contraception?
Sure. It's mostly pretty simple. There was a bill that was run this past legislative session by Representative Ward that kind of clarified what the state standards are, or the state code. So state code right now says, you know, you can't, or that sex standards in the state, when you talk about this in high school and middle school, you should focus on abstinence. But there is a part in the code that was kind of a little muddy that didn't really clarify what teachers could say about contraception. So his bill said teachers can talk about it. They can say, you know, this is the method of a condom, this is kind of the success rate of that, and then, but you can't advocate for it. So that's kind of the line that was cleared up, is you can talk about it, but you definitely cannot advocate for it.
Okay, so words like condom and birth control are now part of the state standard vocab. But so we're moving from teaching only abstinence to stressing abstinence. That seems like a pretty big move for Utah in some ways. What are both proponents and opponents saying of these updates in the language?
Sure. So I think it's been a little messy conversation, right? So you have members of the board, conservative members of the board, saying, you know, this is going too far, you're becoming comprehensive in your sex education. But overall, these are really the same standards, right? They're stressing abstinence. That is still the same code. The state code hasn't changed on this, so the lessons can't change on this. But proponents are excited, you know. Now you're going to have updated information. You know, you're going to have new sources that aren't outdated anymore. I think overall, it's a positive thing, and people are seeing it that way.
And so there's been some debate over the phrase trusted adult that's used in the language here. What's the issue with that?
Sure. So trusted adult was kind of the phrase that board members and the writing committee on these standards have agreed upon to say, you know, if a student is facing any kind of trouble or needs any kind of guidance, they should go to a trusted adult. And then they later define that in the standards as including parents or clergy or coaches. Some of the more conservative members of the board say that that's leaving parents out of the conversation, that it should say parents and trusted adults, just to make sure that the state standards are putting family and putting parents first.
And so what have, opponents is maybe too strong, but what have been some of the criticisms of putting parents first?
Some of the criticisms are just that, you know, there are families, diverse families in the state where some kids have a single parent or are raised by grandparents or don't have a responsible caregiver. And some kids in the state are also experiencing abuse in their own homes and can't necessarily go to a parent to talk about that abuse. They need to go to another trusted adult, as the state would put it.
Okay. And Gerke, I want you to weigh in here a little bit. So after 20 years of set sex ed standards in the state, is this a progressive move for Utah or just about what you expected?
A progressive move? No, not so much. I mean, I guess we're progressing into the 70s, maybe.
From the 50s?
From the 50s. Yeah, that's progress. You know, I think these are going to be ongoing discussions in this state, just given the bugaboo around sexual conduct by young people. It turns out young people do that sort of thing, regardless of whether or not they're taught, you know, about birth control and so forth. And so, and that's why we see we see these outbreaks of STDs from time to time. And I mean, I think it's, you know, it's going to be a constant tug of war, I guess, and you know, it's good to see that there's, you know, two steps forward, one step back, maybe, and so you take the gains where you can.
Right. All right. So, listeners, let's talk about sex. We want to know what you think about these sex standard updates or any of the other stories we've been talking about. Join the conversation by calling 801-355-8255 or tweet us your questions and comments at KCPW. So we're going to move on to our next story, but we're not really moving too far. Planned Parenthood and the ACLU of Utah have announced a federal lawsuit aimed at striking down the state's new 18-week abortion ban, which, of course, has gotten a lot of attention nationally and locally. This story was written by the Tribune's Bethany Rogers. But Dan, I want you to jump in here. What has been the reaction to this lawsuit?
Well, not surprise, because it was very well known from the outset while this bill was being debated, even while it was being drafted, that it was going to be immediately challenged. And so the reaction was, you know, here they are coming with the lawsuit as promised. The reaction of the sponsor, Cheryl Acton from West Jordan, was sort of interesting. She said in an interview on the day that the press conference was held announcing this lawsuit that, you know, she'd kind of always expected this, and she'd like to see this or another state's similar law get all the way to the Supreme Court and test whether the new members President Trump has appointed would, you know, be ready to start taking huge chunks out of the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision. And, you know, the problem with Utah doing this is we're far behind other states. There are already similar laws far down the channel of the court pipeline. And so the idea that we would get there first is almost inconceivable at this point.
It's almost like they're racing, right? I mean, yeah. There were the states that are already ahead of us on the 18-week ban. Now we've got five states that have passed 6-week bans or fetal heartbeat bans. Utah, I mean, and from my perspective as an opinion writer, that's the most frustrating thing about this is why is the legislature so eager to throw money after a lawsuit that's already going to proceed? As we, you know, as Dan said, the conservatives are eager as can be to get an abortion bill in front of the Supreme Court, and it's unlikely that it's going to be Utah's, but it will be one of these that will get there, I'm sure. Whether it's a 15-week ban or an 18-week ban or a fetal heartbeat ban, there will be a case before the Supreme Court within the next year or two, I would imagine.
Yeah, Bethany will have another story coming up this weekend, which is, I think, a very solid follow to this. It's essentially, if you really, your interest is in stopping abortions, there are many more effective ways to do it than this. One of them was a bill passed in the legislature that expands Medicaid. It's estimated that something like 11,000 women now will have contraceptive coverage that didn't have it before. That we also passed a bill 2 years ago that was just recently implemented that allows women to get contraception without a prescription. These kinds of measures are actually going to have a very big difference in reducing the numbers of abortions and unwanted pregnancies in the state. And if you look at the numbers of abortions that would be affected if this 18-week ban were implemented, it's a tiny fraction of the number of abortions that are performed. So this, from the outside, looks kind of all about being a message, electioneering platform, than it is about trying to find an effective way to reduce abortion.
So the state's not, you know, Utah's not alone in this. I mean, Robert Gerke kind of mentioned this, but state legislatures across the nation have considered more than 260 proposals to restrict abortion in some way. The Planned Parenthood and other opponents of this have called it a full-on attack, using some of that language that does definitely makes it kind of sound like a political platform. But you're saying that let's focus on the things like the birth control bill that was passed that allows women to go get birth control without a recurring prescription from their doctor.
I'm just saying if you want to effectively reduce the number of abortions rather than make a political point, these other measures are going to have a rather significant effect on the number of abortions.
Yeah, good.
Right. The best way to stop an abortion is to stop the unwanted pregnancy, I think. And that goes to the sex education discussion we were just having and all of these other measures that Dan was talking about. I mean, the problem with these 6 week bans is those kick in oftentimes before a woman even knows she's pregnant in many cases. The 18-week ban is difficult because, you know, for many of the same reasons, it also has these exemptions for medical necessity. And so, as Dan mentioned, the statistics from Utah are that the overwhelming majority of abortions wouldn't be affected. But, you know, they're trying to narrow the window before the fetal viability of the Supreme Court language kicks in. Supreme Court said that abortion's legal up until the point of fetal viability. Medical technology has changed. What does that mean? And that's where conservatives are pushing on, and they're going to try to push that window down as narrow as they can.
Yeah. If I could just make one more point, I think Absolutely. One of the classic examples of using this kind of legislation to make a statement rather than to make an effect or a change is a bill that the legislature passed, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, about fetal pain. It requires physicians to administer an anesthetic to the fetus on the notion that before an abortion, on the notion that it can feel pain after I don't know how many weeks. An unproven scientific theory. And what we have found is that physicians aren't doing this. They're not following the law. And they've said openly they are not doing it. They consider it a bad medicine and dangerous. And so they're not doing it. But there is no enforcement. And so what was the purpose of the law? Well, it seems only to make a statement.
Right. So we have reached that time in the hour where we need to quickly turn to our final segment of the show, our underplayed stories of the week. So, Courtney, why don't you kick us off?
Sure. Sports writer Alex Behar had this wonderful story, a very sad but a wonderful story, about a Draper man who will be running in the Salt Lake City Marathon. He was diagnosed with cancer, and he's essentially not letting that stop him from participating.
Yeah, that was a nice, heartwarming story. And the marathon kicks off tomorrow. We're here at Library Square at Dinker Studio, and they have set up the tents ready to greet those runners at the end of it. So, Dan Harry, what's your underplayed for the week?
I'm going to talk about another piece of legislation that is a message bill, and it's Representative Ben McAdams' attempt to put a balanced budget constitutional amendment in, which is, as Robert pointed out in his column, never going to happen, but it's a perfect political statement for the lone Democrat in Utah's delegation.
All right. Good.
And just to piggyback on that a little bit, I mean, the frustrating part in the part that I wrote about in my column that frustrates me the most is they talk about passing balanced budget amendments instead of proposing balanced budgets. They just they have the power. It's just they want to be stopped before they spend again, I guess, and they can't control themselves. My underplayed story is that obviously the shooting down in police pursuit and shooting down in South Salt Lake got a lot of attention last week. Aaron Alberti interviewed the owner of the business where the shooting occurred, the truck that crashed into his shop, and then the shooting that occurred afterward. It's a really compelling story. This guy was had moved here from Iraq. He was the tailor to Saddam Hussein's sister. Just a really compelling read and worth checking out at sltrib.com.
Yeah, she had some really amazing color in that story.
Yeah.
And mine is, I'll go with real quickly, is a twofer. Salt Lake has been named as the number 24 best place to live, citing largely that it's become less religious. And Provo, in the same week, was named the least diverse city in America. So thank you to Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner, government and politics editor Dan Harry, and news columnist Robert Gerke for joining us this morning. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to KCPW Operations Director Jesse Ellis and news intern Sarah Sadikon, and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan. Find podcasts of this and all of KCPW's local programs at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. And you can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook at KCPW88.3 or on Twitter at KCPW. I'm Marcy Young-Cancio. Thanks for joining us this morning, and have a great weekend. Roger McDonough will be back next week.